Picture a bright blue ball just spinning, spinning, friend. Dizzy with eternity. Painted with the skin and sky, brushes and clouds of sea. So it looks from space. A closer look reveals the human race. Full of hope, full of grace is the human peace. But afraid, we are merely home to waste.
Good evening, K-Squid listeners. Yes, it's every other Sunday again, and this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. My guest today is Dina Julia Whitaker. Hello, Dina. Are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Ronnie.
We'll be talking about indigenous environmental justice, environmental philosophy, and the restoration of balance between humans and nature. I'm getting a little bit of feedback here, so bear with me. Dina Julia Whitaker is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes in the Pacific Northwest and a lecturer in American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos. She's also a policy director and researcher at the Center for World Indigenous Studies. Dina is author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock, and she's co-author with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, which I am in the process of reading. And Professor Whitaker has just received a journalism award from the Native American Journalist Association for an editorial she wrote for High Country News on indigenizing the Green New Deal, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. So Dina, hello, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Hi, how's it going? How's my sound? Is it okay?
Your sound is great. Mine is not so great,
okay,
but I'll live with it. So this seems to be an especially important time to be talking about social and structural injustice and racism and how they manifest in the common beliefs and practices of the people living on that part of Turtle Island that many call the United States of America. So let's begin by having you tell us something about your background, your research career, and all of that stuff.
Okay, Dina Julia Whitaker, and I'm coming to you from the traditional unceded homelands of the Ohoshaman people in what's known today as Orange County in Southern California. I am a descendant of the Colville Confederated Tribes, which is in Washington State. That's where our current reservation is, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles, so I come to this as, you know, what we call an urban Indian. And the reason that I come to be from Los Angeles, or at least born and raised in L.A. in Southern California, is because of federal policy of the 1950s, which was designed to completely empty the reservations of Native people during a policy era they called termination. So that's a big, long story, but that's really what shapes and frames my life currently. I have a lot of things in my background, including being an artist, you know, a Native American artist, which pretty much led me back into school at a later age, and in journalism as well. And activism. So I really went from being an artist to being an activist, and all of that is pretty much blended together. And then I'm going back to school later in life in order to finish my education and continue learning about Native American rights and history and how environmental realities and activism fits into all of that. So I'm also a surfer because I have been surfing for a very long time, and I live in a surf town. And I also combine my interest in surfing with what we would call indigeneity, or what it means to be to look at surfing and surf culture as a place-based phenomenon, which exists within the context of settler colonialism. So that's a whole other story. But all of that stuff I combine in my work in some very interesting ways, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe we can get back to surfing towards the end of the show as well. So your book, As Long as Grass Grows, is described as being about the indigenization of environmental justice. We've had some guests on the show who've talked about environmental justice, but not about indigenization. So I wonder if you could explain what that means and why it's important.
What it means is that environmental justice, for anybody who knows anything about the world of environmental justice, meaning a discourse that encompasses theory and praxis, or activism and law and policy, really understands that the root of what we call environmental justice, which has only emerged in the early 1980s, and it came out of the activism of Black communities in the South who were trying to protect themselves from the intentional siting of toxic waste dumps. So this concept that we call environmental justice comes out of the activism of ethnic minority communities who are fighting these very real problems. And the more that I studied that when I was a student, the more I realized that almost none of the literature, a vast and growing literature on environmental justice tackles what environmental justice would look like from an American Indian perspective. And so I was just doing research, as an undergrad and then later in grad school, and I wrote this master's thesis on the topic of what environmental justice should look like as this discourse from an American Indian studies. So what indigenizing it simply means, putting American Indians at the center of that conversation. And the reason that it's important is because we talk about this concept of environmental racism, which is what environmental justice hinges on, this concept. And it's useful only to a point for American Indians. And it's only to a point because at some point the concept of racism is not enough to describe the reality of American Indian people in the U.S. who are not just ethnic minorities, but who are nations with territories and treaties and altogether different relationships to land than anybody else in the United States. So basically, I had to set out to write the book that I wanted to read as a student. It does something that no other book does, and that hopefully opens up to a whole other conversation that other scholars will build on in time.
There are a number of things that I wanted to pick up, but let me start first with your critique of distributive approaches to justice. And the idea, which I connect to the economic liberalism that the system in which we live. But what exactly is the nature of your critique of distributive approaches to justice, which essentially means giving people more of what they lack?
Right, in a material way. And so it always exists within the capitalist state, right? So distributive justice fundamentally looks at justice in a way that is very often and probably most of the time monetarily based. But in terms of environmental justice, it means the difference between, and I say this in the book, between, and quoting somebody, another scholar on this, between poisoning people equally, distributing the risk of environmental harm equally across all populations versus not poisoning people at all. But that's only a piece of it. The other piece is that, you know, understanding that this distributive mode of justice is really the predominant mode of the American legal system, and that it doesn't address the concepts of justice that Native people use, which we could call a restorative mode of justice, which is really about restoring right relationships. So it's seeing injustice in a lens or through a lens that understands that things are out of balance, that so it's relational. So understanding that, you know, these relations, in this case, you know, the relationship between tribal nations and the federal government are out of balance. And so what does it mean from an indigenous perspective or from any perspective to restore the balance of those relationships in order to achieve justice? There's a whole analysis about distributive justice that gets very, very deep, you know, with scholars like David Harvey, for example, who's a sort of a giant in the world of environmental justice literature, you know, from a Marxist perspective.
Well, sorry, I lost my train of thought there. The thing about even a lot of the critique, it seems to me, is that it still sees structural remedies to injustice as somehow arising out of, you might say, the instruments of the dominant society. I'm not quite sure how to phrase that.
That's a really good way of putting it.
But you know, the idea of right relationship is something that I wanted to talk about later, but let's talk about it now. What exactly does that mean, right relationship?
So this is an epistemological question, and that's a very, you know, a very fancy academic word that means epistemology, or the word epistemology simply means systems of knowledge, like how societies come to know the things that they know.
Right.
And it's like going back to that, it's also ontological, that is, like understanding the origin of things. These are always culturally based. And in a system of Western, like the Western, Euro-Western society, we're talking about philosophical issues here, philosophical foundations. And these epistemological, philosophical foundations are something that most, like, Westerners or dominant society thinks are universal, right? That there are universal traits that are common across all human societies. And the problem is that that's not true. In indigenous epistemology, for example, you see that this concept of relationality really structures everything. You can't say the same thing about Western dominant society, and certainly not in the legal realm. But in indigenous worldviews are structured in this way that understands humans as in relation to everything else, and thus really not, it's not anthropocentric in that way. But when you have a worldview constructed that way, then there are other things that emerge from that, or that flow from that, such as the concept of reciprocity. So in a relational system, you automatically are talking about relationships built on reciprocity and responsibility and respect. So Native people see themselves as responsible to those webs of relationships that they exist within. And so this is a very different framework than you will see in the dominant society. And when we talk about restoring right relationships, it means not just among humans, but among humans and the natural world. And so, you know, this is what, and we're starting to see more and more of this relational kind of thinking in scholarship as scholars from other disciplines start looking at indigenous knowledge, and you really see it in feminist studies more and more. But even Western science disciplines are starting to look at indigenous knowledge as a basis from which to learn from and hopefully draw from in finding solutions to these massive problems that we have that are, especially the ecological, environmental problems.
I have to take a break, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. Over to you, Alex.
Thanks, Ronnie. The County of Santa Cruz now has two donation distribution sites for those affected by the CZU Lightning Complex fires. The first is located at St. Peter and St. Paul Orthodox Church, 9980 Highway 9, Ben Lomond, open Wednesday 4 through 7 p.m. and Sunday 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The other is located at Valley Churches United, 9400 Highway 9, Ben Lomond, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Valley Churches United will continue accepting donations on behalf of those in need. Please call 831-336-8258 to make arrangements prior to dropping off any donated items. Now back to Ronnie with Sustainability Now.
Hi, you're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm speaking with Dean Julia Whitaker, who is a lecturer in American Indian Studies at California State University, San Marcos. We were just talking about the notion of right relationships, especially between humans and nature. And I wanted to pursue that topic a little bit more, Dina, because there is, you know, somewhere in the book you also talk about the rights of nature, and there's this peculiar aspect to the idea of talking about rights, which is that unless you accept the idea of natural rights, right, somehow inherent in the ontology or the meaning of the universe, rights are things that have to be recognized by human beings. And the idea of relationships, it seems to me, and you mentioned reciprocity and respect, seems to me to be a way to get around this problem of, possibly, this problem of rights. Have you thought about that at all or written about that?
Well, I think that that's, you know, the problem is that we're operating within systems of, again, these Western legal systems, and this concept of rights of nature is, it doesn't exactly describe, and you're right, so it doesn't exactly describe, indigenous concepts of reciprocity and relationality, but this idea of rights for nature is a step closer to that within a legal framework, and it's worth paying attention to and drawing on in legal structures. And tribal nations are starting to do this. There's something else here too that's the difference for tribal nations, like tribes that have governments, are working within frameworks that what we would call, for example, IRA governments or Indian Reorganization Act. That's a big topic there, but these tribal governments are using, and there's three of them now, or maybe four of them now. There are one or two since I wrote the book, but we're looking at the Ponca Nation, the Ho-Chunks in Wisconsin, the Karuks have also enshrined the rights of nature in their tribal constitution as well. So it's a way to extend this importance of the natural world in these Western-style governments. Now, that's different than what we would call customary governments, like customary forms of governance. Most tribal nations do not have customary forms of governance systems that structure their current day constitutions, because these IRA constitutional governments are imposed systems from the federal government from a century ago. So again, this is a really big, complicated conversation, but what we're seeing is tribes that are seeing the usefulness of this framework to express the importance of the natural world, even though they're already, it's already embedded in their customary governance systems. The concept of rights is fraught. It's not perfect for tribal nations who already have these concepts built into their cultures. But it's also following on the heels of other governments internationally who are using this framework of rights of nature to protect their natural landscapes, notably in Ecuador and New Zealand. So the New Zealand, really influenced by the indigenous Maori population, have used this framework as well to protect a particular watershed, river and mountain watershed.
Well, I always say that I will never get into an argument with an economist about economics, because the economist will always outtalk me. And I worry about using rights concepts and language because lawyers are so smart. And the reason I bring this up is because states give rights and they can take away rights. And so relying on the idea of rights of nature seems to me, again, as I said, unless you come from, take it as being part of natural law, comes from some kind of recognition from the state. And that then becomes a very fragile basis. I don't want to pursue this because it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. But let me sort of link it to something you also write in the book, you write about very real cultural values that view the earth as a living relative to be honored and not harmed. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what it means to see the earth and inhabitants of nature as, relatives. And does that in some way trump this idea of rights?
Well, I would say I agree with you that the concept of rights is extremely problematic. And yet, we're operating within a paradigm that forces that concept on us. So it's like many people have had to learn to use all the tools that are available to them, even if they're imperfect. So the rights of nature framework is really only one avenue. It's certainly, in the way that I write about it in the book, it's certainly not the only, avenue to pursue in the project to restore this relational worldview. And, so we have to accept that. There are other things, too. The thing for Native people is that in this different paradigm, this relational paradigm, this indigenous knowledge, we'll just call it indigenous knowledge paradigm. In that paradigm, as I wrote about in the book, the legal system has no mechanism to recognize it because it's a whole different language. And so as, like we talk about the Ling decision from 1988, which justified the desecration of a sacred site in Northern California in the Karuk traditional territory and other tribes. There was no mechanism to recognize indigenous concepts of sacred in a way that allowed it to be protected. And this is the problem that we have in law. There are such limitations because of that concept. They don't get it. They don't get that the concept of the sacred is connected to the earth. the legal structure just doesn't it doesn't have a mechanism to recognize it. So now I'm sort of getting on a tangent. I'm losing my train of thought. But
actually, you know, I mean, this gets to the whole issue of how Western society views land, and that actually. Feeds into this question that I had about the conqueror model. But before I do that, you know, the book is structured and your work is structured around the concept of settler colonialism and the process of indigenous erasure. And I wonder, you know, it seems, again, that's quite important in terms of understanding the various movements now. Can you tell us, explain that to us, and how that settler colonialism operated and operates?
Yeah, so that's a really key point, because that's the framework within which we're having this conversation.
Right.
From an academic standpoint, more and more we are using this theoretical foundation for understanding the United States, and we've had this framework of colonialism for a long time, but it's become more honed in the context of what we call settler states. So it really makes the distinction in different types of colonialism. So, you know, we had the colonization of entire continents in Africa and in Asia and North and South America through these processes of, you know, in the last 500 years of, you know, European so-called exploration. It took different paths. In Africa, in places like Africa and Asia, colonization by Europeans, we're talking about the British, Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the French, and a handful of others, what they did was they went to those places to extract resources and use the local populations, the indigenous populations, to do the labor so that those resources would be sent back home to the metropoles or to the empires.
Right.
In settler colonialism, something different happened. They came for the land. They didn't come just to extract resources and send them back, but they came to claim the land, and it resulted in wholesale population transfer, and ultimately was about replacing the indigenous populations. That's why you have these histories of genocide, these very brutal and violent histories. So, you know, in those other places in Africa and Asia where we have this, what they call franchise colonialism, they were able to decolonize. And decolonizing in those frameworks meant that, you know, through these very difficult processes, were able to expel the colonizing, you know, powers. And so, and to regain independence, and that's what happened all over Africa and in Asia, especially in India. But in the United States and other settler countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Hawaii, and I'm including Hawaii as a country because it was a separate country,
right.
And other places in the South Pacific, you know, it's a different process. You can't, you know, they came here to stay, and now you have entire settler populations where it's not possible for them to just pack up and go home. Like, so we have to be able to imagine what decolonization looks like in this particular context. So this is how the conqueror model fits in. This is a cognitive, and this is not something that I came up with. This really came from the work of Stephen Newcomb, whose work on the doctrine of discovery, which is a legal doctrine that's at the heart of the U.S. legal system.
Newspapers can't keep up with fast-breaking news, and the Internet...
Hold on a second.
Oops.
Well, listen, let's take a break for a second, and let's come back to that, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Now, Steve, Alex.
Sorry about that, Ronnie.
Newspapers can't keep up with fast-breaking news, and the internet can only reach so far. But radio is just a motion away, and KSQD is here for you 24/7. We do it with your help. You can donate at ksqd.org by clicking on Support.
Now back to Sustainability Now.
Hi, yes, this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm speaking with Dina Julia Whitaker, who teaches Native American Studies at California State University San Marcos and is author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. You know, the whole idea of, I mean, to go back to the land, because the land really is key to all of this, right? The view from England was that North America was unoccupied and essentially unutilized, right? And that land only is, that land must be cultivated. Let me put it that way. It's not just the value of land. And you link that to, I think, to Christianity and the conqueror model. So can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, so the conqueror model was about, this points to the fact that settler colonialism, you know, we talk about it being a structure. So it's not, it's more than just a historic event. It's not something that happens and that can be undone, or that is no longer relevant, because what it results in is this structure of ongoing genocide, really, and it's culturally genocidal at this point. And it does this by continuing to disrupt Native people from their connection to land through and their identities as well. So it does this in a whole lot of different ways. But, you know, Standing Rock is a perfect example. Like the Standing Rock No Dapple movement was a perfect example of how these battles continue to play out. You know, the Dakota Access Pipeline was scheduled to come within a half a mile of the Standing Rock Reservation's boundaries, but the area that was coming through was treaty recognized territories, and it was land that was taken illegally outside the bounds of the treaties that were signed in 1851 and 1868. And this was crucial to understand. So these are what we would say unceded lands, and what the Lakota say unceded lands, and the ways that the dominant society I would call the hegemon, that is the dominator in this conqueror model, the way it maintains that power in a way that Native nations never consented to. And so these are always contested spaces. And that's why you have the kinds of resistance movements that continue, and why Standing Rock was such a flashpoint that brought it into the face of mainstream America. Are you there?
Hi, Dina. It looks like we might have lost Ronnie. We'll take a quick break, and I'll see if I can get him back on.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Tune into our award-winning morning news program right here during primetime, 8 o'clock weekday mornings, right here on KSQD on KSQD. Our independent news program offers diverse perspectives, unique opinions unheard in the mainstream media, live as the news unfolds. Tune in for Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, weekday mornings at 8, right here on KSQD Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
Join us here for Cats on Dogs, insights for both ends of the leash. I'm certified professional dog trainer Lori Katz, and I'm joined here in studio by my assistant's dog, Chopa. We feature in-depth interviews with world-class dog training experts who often offer discounts to listeners on their recent publications. You also have the opportunity to send out love songs and condolence messages to your canine companions. If your dogs have gotten into mischief, Chopa grants them absolution in his canine confessional. Join us the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Come, sit, stay, listen to Cats on Dogs on K-Squid.
Am I back online?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay, well, I was fooling around here and made a technical error. Let's change the topic. How's that? Because I can't remember exactly where we were.
I was talking about how this Conqueror model really translated into the Dakota Access Pipeline conflict.
Yes, right. And what happens next? What happens now?
What happens now?
Well, I mean, in the sense that the issues, right, that gave rise to Standing Rock have not gone away. The structure, the legal structure, the structures of justice are still there. There's a lot of activism right now, which I think is directed against these. But, you know, the issue is not resolved. And you know, how do you... I'm really interested in thinking about how we get to a relational system and away from this sort of instrumental and rights-based system. And I think in some ways that's one of the things that Standing Rock highlighted. I mean, have you thought about that? For instance, your article about indigenizing the Green New Deal. Why don't we talk about that for a few minutes, okay? You know, how do you...
Sure.
How do you see the struggle continuing? Let me put it that way. Let me be blunt about it.
Well, you know, even the concept of indigenizing the Green New Deal is highly problematic. It's just demanding that indigenous voices be incorporated into that. But ultimately, the Green New Deal is relies on a distributive capitalist framework. I mean, it understands sustainability in purely economic terms. That's hugely problematic. Ultimately, and this is the topic of my current work, which I have I'm under contract for another book with Beacon Press. And I address this much more in depth in this book by arguing for what I call a transformational land ethic. And so it's taking that idea that Aldo Leopold talked about, you know, in the 1940s in his famous essay, The Land Ethic,
right.
Which was considered so revolutionary at the time. And yet, for indigenous people, it's just the way native people have always lived, you know, in recognition of this relational association with the natural world. So, you know, Aldo Leopold was like, oh, well, you know, from an American Indian standpoint, you know, he's like kind of a late to the game. But, on the other hand, you know, we have N. Scott Momaday, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Kiowa, highly celebrated writer. And he, in 1997, also wrote a essay about an American land ethic. And he basically kind of echoes Aldo Leopold, but from an indigenous perspective. And he says that, you know, unless as Americans, and he's talking about all of us as Americans, kind of all lumped in together, unless we all recognize that, you know, we're in deep trouble, and that's, you know, 1997. And from my perspective, unless the United States reckons with and accounts for its profoundly violent history of genocide, its foundation in genocide and land theft, and this ongoing structure, unless that's accounted for, there's no way to get to any kind of a relational land ethic. So that has to be part of it, recognizing that this happened. And, oh, by the way, Native Americans, maybe they really did understand their relationship to the natural world, and maybe there is something for us to learn from that in a way that is not appropriative, that is not disrespectful, but allows them to lead the way. And that means that has to be recognized by the legal system, it has to be recognized by the political system, and it has to be recognized by science. So it's this ethic of accountability that needs to happen, or we can't get there as a country. So that's kind of how I'm seeing it. You know, it's indigenous knowledge. So ultimately, it's a philosophy problem. Going back full circle to where we started this conversation, it's a problem of philosophy and epistemology that needs to transform in this country. It's not a problem of technology and economics. Those are only pieces of this much larger puzzle. Because unless humans address the ways that we are living on the earth based on endless extraction, even green energy is the way that we talk about it is extremely insufficient. And it doesn't recognize the environmental harms that are inherent in green energy systems. So that's a whole other conversation.
You know, I think in asking my question, I was invoking Marx when he, said something to the effect that the philosophers have told us how the world works. The key issue is how to change it, right? And so, I mean, I agree with you about philosophy and epistemology and ontology, but the question then is, what do we do? But I'm not expecting, I'm not expecting you to have the solution. It's just something that I think a lot of us are hungering for. One before we take another break, I did want to bring something up, and that has to do with this question of property and possession. In Native American concepts, the Western society looks at property as mine, and how does the view differ amongst Native Americans of things that one has?
It can be really summed up into that phrase that we're all probably familiar with the land doesn't belong to us, we belong to the land. Right. And so it's, decentering the human control of land. Again, bringing it back around to the fact, to this idea that we are just part of the land. We emerge from the land. Native people as spatially based or place-based people, this is it's really hard for non-Native people to grasp. I mean, I think you can grasp it kind of on an intellectual level, but not in a way that is like where you feel it in your bones, like Native people, it's embedded in their languages, it's embedded in their religions, it's embedded in everything, and their lives are structured around that. And so when you have that kind of way of living, then there's an egalitarianness to it. And that's not to say that Native peoples didn't have boundaries, because they have very clear boundaries, and sometimes those boundaries conflicted with each other, and sometimes they even fought wars over those boundaries. But they were never boundaries or wars about religion, for sure. And there was in many cases a sense of what you could say ownership over particular areas, like fishing sites, for example, like where I'm from on the Columbia River, the Columbia River people and their salmon fisheries. There were fishing places that were owned by family groups, and everybody understood that, and there was a respect for that, and you wouldn't dream of broaching those boundaries. It just wouldn't have been done because of, you know, this relationship of respect that constructs these societies. So even that's open to, you know, the idea that Native Americans never owned land. That's up for question, because there are these times and places where they're very much territorially based.
I have to take a break. But before I do that, I think using the very concept of property is problematic in this kind of discussion. You know, because again, if you mention property to an economist, it immediately sort of crystallizes as something that can be bought and sold. It's an example of how language structures the way we think. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial in Santa Cruz and KSQT.org. Alex?
Thanks, Ronnie. Tune in to KSQD at 6 p.m. for State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. In this episode, Deborah is joined by disaster response expert and Red Cross volunteer Dr. Diane Bridgman and wildfire survivors Sarah and Sam Clarkson. They discuss the mental health impacts of disasters and explore how individuals and communities recover in the immediate aftermath of recent wildfires, and while still sifting through the ashes of their emotions and possessions, Sam and Sarah tenderly share their experiences with emergency evacuation, losing their home, and finding a road forward. Psychologist Diane Bridgman helps us understand the mental health impacts and how we, as individuals and communities, recover together and build resilience. Join us on State of Mind, coming up at 6, here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Back to you, Ronnie.
Hi, you're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Dina Gilio Whitaker, author of As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. Dina, let's sort of change the subject. And one of the things you write about in the book is the central role of women in indigenous cultures, actions, and politics. And can you talk to us about that?
It's a really important part of the work that I do as a writer, as a teacher, that part of this process of colonization, as we were talking about before, and settler colonialism. So we talk about patriarchal settler colonialism. So Native societies, by and large, almost straight across the board, were matrilineal or matrifocal or matriarchal even societies. And what that means is that those societies were gender balanced. And so they were equitable. They were gender equitable societies where women inherently had, different types of political power. And the process of colonization with Christianity, the imposition of Christianity, patriarchal Christianity, had profound, profound impacts on Native societies. And so patriarchy is now something that is embedded in our societies, and we're trying to, you know, part of our projects to decolonize is to decolonize that and rematriate our own communities. And we saw that, you know, again at Standing Rock, we saw how Native women were really central to that whole resistance event, and it was kind of a turning point in a way in that regard. It was really youth driven and women led, and this is different from the movements like the American Indian movement that we saw during the Red Power era in the 1960s and 70s, because that movement was male dominated. We always talk about the men having the mic, but it was women behind the scenes, and that history hasn't really been written, although I think it's starting to get written. But this was part of what was happening at that time behind the scenes. Like, women were seeing how men had taken this power in a way because, and in a colonized way, because they had forgotten. They had forgotten in their own communities, in their own tribes, in their own cultures, that women had these leadership roles, and so they, you know, sort of usurped those roles, and there were problems with it. But Standing Rock was such a beautiful example of women taking back that power. And if we look at, we go back to the Red Power Movement, or even earlier, to a century ago in the early 1900s, during the Progressive Era, this is when Native people really start to take their power and organize in their resistance against the government imposition into their lives. And it happens really in 1911 with the formation of the Society of American Indians. And this is a time where white women still don't have the vote, and they don't even have the right to own property. But the Society of American Indians is founded by men and women, and women have just as much leadership as the men do in this. And so they're, you know, using that and pushing for, you know, rights for Native American. In the 1970s, with the Red Power Movement, you see Native women who are leading the charge or leading these actions around environmental issues because of the reproductive problems that they're having on their reservations, especially around the contamination of uranium mines. In South Dakota, for example, you know, women were having, you know, high rates of miscarriages, high rates of birth defects in their children, and these kinds of problems. And so they're organizing. They form into the Women of All Red Nations, and they are entering this field, and it's all, you know, through this reproductive rights issue, and it's all connected to the environment. So, you know, the event at Standing Rock is, you know, I see that as a continuation of that. So women reclaiming those spaces and those roles.
I don't want to essentialize matriarchy or women, but if you get back to the talking about the relationship to the land, is there something about a matriarchal, matrilineal society that somehow, you know, has a different relationship to land than one that's dominated by men? I mean, I'm just sort of trying to think about that, not with a clear question, I'm afraid.
Well, I think it's a fair thought, and I think that you can safely make that assumption without essentializing, that, you know, Native societies always saw the land in sort of female terms, because, you know, we talk about Mother Earth, right?
Right.
And, you know, the earth is what, you know, gives birth, you know, the Lakota say Unchi Maka, you know, Grandmother Earth. She is what gives birth and gives life to all of us. And so yeah, it's a very common worldview. You don't see, and I think that's really, it really comes out of these cultures that are matriarchal. You know, when we hear terms in other contexts, like, you know, in South America, for example, in coming out of the Spanish, and they talk about the fatherland, or in other places, you know, the fatherland, the earth is paternalized. And I think that comes directly out of these patriarchal colonial frameworks. But, you know, it makes a lot more sense to see the earth in maternal or feminine terms.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time, so I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about the Institute of Women Surfers and surfing.
going back to that, In my work, I've been fortunate to, because I'm always bringing this kind of indigenous and indigenous feminist perspective to everything I do, even surfing. Like, surfing is, oh, there's a such a big conversation there, but, you know, surfing, the way surf history has been written for a century, there was so much they got wrong and so much they left out. And so there's this larger project right now in the scholarly realm, in what we call critical surf studies, that is doing these history correctives, and writing from different perspectives about what surf culture is and what it actually did and how what it is manifests in still very problematic ways and comes out in things like territorialism and, you know, chauvinism, you know, sexism and all these isms, because it's been male-dominated for so long. But, you know, surfing, it originated in Hawaii. Surfing as we know it today originated in Hawaii. And if you look at the history, and this history is very well documented, it was a woman-centered sport. And there are lots of stories in the Hawaiians call them their mo'olelo, their origin stories, and lots of stories about surfing, and women are centered in those stories. And so, like, that's a history that's, you know, talk about erasure, that's a history that's been erased but is now becoming recovered. And why? Because history, you know, in Hawaii, America, surfing gets appropriated in a way to turn Hawaii into this, you know, tourist paradise in order to attract white people and disempower the native Hawaiian population. So, you know, like, those are examples of, like, what we mean when we say critical surf studies and how we're changing those narratives and doing those historical correctives.
Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Dina, for being on Sustainability Now. I enjoyed our conversation. I hope we can continue it, and I hope our listeners found it interesting, too. So, listeners, you can find out more by looking up Dina Julia Whitaker on the Internet, and I've put links on the Sustainability Now archive of this particular show. So in 2 weeks, join me for a conversation with Mayra Hernandez, a community organizer at the Community Water Center in Watsonville. The Community Water Center works towards realizing the human right to water for all communities in California through education, organizing, and advocacy, with offices in Visalia, Sacramento, and Watsonville. So that's Sunday, October 18th, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the Internet. And just as a reminder, shows from this 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m., and you can hear previous shows on ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow. Our fall pledge drive begins tomorrow, and it's not too early today to help us. Just go to ksqd.org and look for the donate button. I want to give thanks to Alex Snyder for today's excellent engineering and everyone else at the station who makes this show possible. I want to say that the Grateful Dead clip was at the request of Dino Julia Whitaker, and I thought it was a very appropriate clip. So until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Brushes and clouds to see. Look home for you and me. Peaceful place, the sword looks from space. A closer look reveals the human race. Full of hope, full of grace is the human.